Every Friday evening, convicts came to our ward from other parts of the prison on purpose to see Isai Fomich celebrate his Sabbath. Isai Fomich was so naively vain and boastful that this general interest gave him pleasure too. With pedantic and studied gravity, he covered his little table in the corner, opened his book, lit two candles, and muttering some mysterious words, began putting on his vestment. It was a multicoloured shawl of woollen material which he kept carefully in his box. He tied phylacteries on both hands and tied some sort of wooden ark on his head by means of a bandage right over his forehead, so that it looked like a ridiculous horn sprouting out of his forehead. Then the prayer began. He repeated it in a chant, uttered cries, spat on the floor, and turned round, making wild and absurd gesticulations. All this, of course, was part of the ceremony, and there was nothing absurd or strange about it. But what was absurd was that Isai Fomich seemed purposely to be playing a part before us, and made a show of his ritual. Suddenly he would hide his head in his hands and recite with sobs. The sobs grew louder, and in a state of exhaustion and almost howling, he would let his head, crowned with the ark, drop on the book. But suddenly, in the middle of the most violent sobbing, he would begin to laugh and chant in a voice broken with feeling and solemnity and weak with bliss. "Isn't he going for it?" the convicts commented. I once asked Isai Fomich what was the meaning of the sobs, and then the sudden solemn transition to happiness and bliss. Isai Fomich particularly liked such questions from me. He at once explained to me that the weeping and sobbing were aroused at the thought of the loss of Jerusalem, and that the ritual prescribed sobbing as violently as possible and beating the breast at the thought. But at the moment of the loudest sobbing, he, Isai Fomich, was suddenly, as it were, accidentally, the suddenness was also prescribed by the ritual, to remember that there is a prophecy about the return of the Jews to Jerusalem. Then he must at once burst into joy, song, and laughter, and must repeat his prayers in such a way that his voice itself should express as much happiness as possible, and his face should express all the solemnity and dignity of which it was capable. This sudden transition and the obligation to make it were a source of extreme pleasure to Isai Fomich. He saw in it a very subtle trick, and boastfully told me of this difficult rule. Once, when the prayer was in full swing, the major came into the ward accompanied by the officer on duty and the sentries. All the convicts drew themselves up by the bed. Isai Fomich alone began shouting and carrying on more than ever. He knew that the prayer was not prohibited, it was impossible to interrupt it, and of course there was no risk in his shouting before the major. But he particularly enjoyed making a display before the major and showing off before us. The major went up to within a step of him. Isai Fomich turned with his back to his table and, waving his hands, began chanting his solemn prophecy right in the major's face. As it was prescribed for him to express extreme happiness and dignity in his face at that moment, he did so immediately, screwing up his eyes in a peculiar way, laughing and nodding his head at the major. The major was surprised, but finally went off into a guffaw, called him a fool to his face, and walked away, and Isai Fomich vociferated louder than ever. An hour later, when he was having supper, I asked him, "And what if the major in his foolishness had flown into a rage?"
"What major?"
"What major? Why, didn't you see him?"
"No."
"Why, he stood not a yard away from you, just facing you." But Isai Fomich began earnestly assuring me that he had not seen the major, and that at the time, during the prayer, he was usually in such a state of ecstasy that he saw nothing and heard nothing of what was going on around him. I can see Isai Fomich before me now, as he used to wander about the prison on Saturdays with nothing to do, making tremendous efforts to do nothing at all, as prescribed by the law of the Sabbath. What incredible anecdotes he used to tell me every time he came back from the synagogue. What prodigious news and rumours from Petersburg he used to bring me, assuring me that he had got them from his fellow Jews, and that they had them first hand. But I have said too much about Isai Fomich. There were only two public baths in the town. One of these, which was kept by a Jew, consisted of separate bathrooms, for each of which a fee of 50 kopecks was charged. It was an establishment for people of the higher class. The other bathhouse was intended for the working class. It was dilapidated, dirty, and small, and it was to this house that we convicts were taken. It was frosty and sunny, and the convicts were delighted at the very fact of getting out of the fortress grounds and looking at the town. The jokes and laughter never flagged all the way. A whole platoon of soldiers with loaded rifles accompanied us, to the admiration of the whole town. In the bathhouse, we were immediately divided into two relays. The second relay had to wait in the cold anteroom while the first were washing themselves. This division was necessary because the bathhouse was so small. But the space was so limited that it was difficult to imagine how even half of our number could find room. Yet Pietrov did not desert me. He skipped up of his own accord to help and even offered to wash me. Another convict who offered me his services was Baklushin, a prisoner in the special division who was nicknamed the Pioneer and to whom I have referred already as one of the liveliest and most charming of the convicts, as indeed he was. I was already slightly acquainted with him. Pietrov even helped me to undress, for, not being used to it, I was slow undressing, and it was cold in the anteroom, almost as cold as in the open air. It is, by the way, very difficult for a convict to undress till he has quite mastered the art. To begin with, one has to learn how to unlace the bands under the ankle irons quickly. These bands are made of leather, are 8 inches in length, and are put on over the undergarment, just under the ring that goes round the ankle. A pair of these bands costs no less than 60 kopecks, and yet every convict procures them, at his own expense, of course, for it is impossible to walk without them. The ring does not fit tightly on the leg. One can put one's finger in between, so that the iron strikes against the flesh and rubs it, and without the leather, a convict would rub his leg into a sore in a day. But it is not difficult to get the bands off. It is more difficult to learn how to get off one's underwear from under the fetters. It is quite a special art. Drawing off the undergarment from the left leg, for instance, one has first to pull it down between the ring and the leg. Then, freeing one's foot, one has to draw the linen up again between the leg and the ring. Then the whole of the left leg of the garment has to be slipped through the ring on the right ankle and pulled back again. One has to go through the same business when one puts on clean linen. It is hard for a novice even to guess how it can be done. I was first taught how to do it at Tobolsk by a convict called Korenev, who had been the chief of a band of robbers and had been chained to the wall for 5 years. But the convicts get used to it and go through the operation without the slightest difficulty.